You're listening to Vatican Radio.
2016 marks the 125th anniversary of Pope Leo XIII's groundbreaking encyclical Rerum Novarum, which is universally recognized as having begun the tradition of Catholic social teaching in the modern age. Renowned for its moral defense of private property and capital ownership, it is equally strong in its stand against state socialism and its unambiguous affirmation of the legitimacy of trade unions, as well as the unimpeachable rights of the traditional family. Rerum Novarum addressed the demands for freedom and social justice in a time and in a way that continues to challenge and inform social discourse a century and a quarter later. The Rome office of the Acton Institute for Religion and Liberty has sponsored and organized a major international conference under the title Freedom with Justice, Rerum Novarum and the New Things of Our Time, to take place Wednesday, April 20th. Acton's Director of Research, Dr. Samuel Gregg, joins us to discuss the conference and its themes. Dr. Gregg, thank you for coming in and seeing us. I know you're busy getting ready for the event, which is taking place on Wednesday afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
The themes of Rerum Novarum their addresses were quite specific to the time. We're in 1891, a period of great social and political upheaval that had been going on for 50-odd years in Europe. Political and social upheaval across the board in Europe and beyond, in which it was not at all clear which direction economic development under the impetus of the industrialization process was going to go. So Rerum Novarum comes in a very specific moment in history. Is its address of these questions dated?
No. In fact, I think there's many things about Rerum Novarum that are, in fact, timeless, partly because the encyclical draws very specifically upon natural optimistic thought when it discusses things like, for example, its defense, its very rigorous defense, one has to say, of private property. But also its very strong critique of socialism. If you look at Rerum Novarum, the first 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs, maybe even something like 25 to 30% of the encyclical, is a critique of socialism, which at the time was a very powerful, strong movement, particularly in Western Europe, but also in parts of the United States. And some would say today that socialism is back in some respects, in the sense that you see on the political left a move towards much more explicit affirmations of what you might call basic socialist ideas than we've seen for quite some time, at least since the fall of communism. So I think it's rigorous defense of private property, which I think is something that, if anything, is needed even more today. It's critique of socialism, but also the fact that the encyclical took the modern world seriously. If you read the encyclical, like most of Leo XIII's pontificate, it's an effort to grapple with this new world that had been created by the Industrial Revolution, which, as you said in your remarks, had really been going on for at least 50 years before the encyclical came out, and the massive changes that it was creating socially, politically, economically, not just in Europe, but also North America, but also, in fact, anywhere where the European world was achieving global reach. And that was, at the time, because of colonization, virtually the whole globe. So there's many things, I think, about Rerum Novarum that are worth reading today and then looking at the contemporary scene and saying, well, where does this still apply? And I think we find it applies in many, many areas.
You are yourself a defender of the free market.
Yes.
And if I could put it this way, an unapologetic apologist. therefore, but the and you mentioned the rigorous defense of private property. Mm-hmm. That Rerum Novarum puts forward, as well as its critique, equally rigorous and I don't think it's too much to say devastating critique.
Devastating critique is an understatement, actually.
Of socialism. all forms of socialism, or specifically state socialism and more specifically communism?
Well, that's a good point, because in the encyclical itself, Leo raises himself the question of whether there are more moderate forms of socialism, which might in some respects be more acceptable. Pius XI asked the same question in Quadragesimo Anno, 40 years later. And both popes came to the conclusion that part of the fundamental problem with any form of socialism was its materialism. That socialism was fundamentally based upon a materialist understanding of the human person and of life. And, you know, socialism also at the time was very much associated in many circles with atheism as well, because of this materialist side. So it seems to me that when you read the encyclical, the critique applies just as much to what might be called more moderate forms of socialism at the time, which are a somewhat different beast from what you find with contemporary social democracy, and certainly state socialism in the sense that we saw emerge in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Well, that's always been off the board as far as the church is concerned.
Well, once you do that, if we were to compare it sort of to the Olympic judging process, you exclude the highest and the lowest score.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That leaves a pretty broad range of possibilities for establishing policy and for really for organizing and ordering society that is left up to the prudential judgment of those who are responsible.
Which were primarily lay people, lay Catholics. And this is a very important point because I think when you think about Catholic social teaching, there's this tendency to think that it often translates into one specific political program. And that is not actually the case, especially that the magisterium itself says that it doesn't offer a concrete program for political and economic order. What it does do is articulate principles like the dignity of the person, the principle of freedom, the principle of solidarity, the principle of subsidiarity, the universal destination of material goods, the rights of private property, etc., etc. And these principles are very important because they're grounded in scripture, they're derived from natural law, and they're timeless in a sense. But the church has always recognized that when it comes to the precise business of applying these in terms of policy, that within that spectrum that you talked about, there's a wide variety of positions that Catholics can, in good conscience, take. And sometimes I think that's not particularly well understood by even a good number of faithful Catholics who are anxious to learn more about and apply the church's social teaching. If you look at the social teaching, there's a variety of possible policy positions that flow from it, which might be, in some respects, contradicting each other, but nonetheless are all consistent with the principles of the social teaching.
The conference, then, is a celebration of Rerum Novarum. Mm-hmm. It's also a critical appraisal.
Yes.
What do you hope to recover from Rerum Novarum, then, that perhaps in the development of Catholic social doctrine over the intervening century and a quarter has perhaps not received the emphasis that it might have?
Well, a couple of things. I think the first point to note is I'm actually surprised that there aren't more Catholic organizations, universities, for example, that are marking the occasion of Rerum Novarum, its 125th anniversary. This is a very, very important document in the history of the Catholic Church, and I'm frankly surprised that more organizations are not celebrating it. And one of the reasons I think why we're engaging in a type of critical appraisal of it, and what I would like and others would like to see come from this event, is an understanding, for example, on just one level, of just how important natural law is for thinking about the social, political, and economic order. Because Rerum Novarum, of all the Catholic social encyclicals, is by far the most explicit in its reference to Thomistic principles, to natural law reasoning. And that's partly because Leo XIII was very anxious that the Church engage and recover Thomistic thought precisely so that it could engage the modern world on the ground of reason, because the modern world is all about reason, right? Well, Leo was trying to say at the time, well, we also believe in reason, and we actually think that our understanding of reason is a more coherent and richer idea of reason, and that's why we think it has something to offer to thinking about the social, political, and economic order. If you look at a lot of subsequent Catholic social teaching, particularly since Vatican II, there's been a remarkably less emphasis upon natural law. And I think that natural law, one of the things it does is it injects rigor and coherence into the way that we think about social, political, and economic questions, which is what Rerum Novarum was at one level trying to do. And I'd like to see more Catholic social teaching in the future follow that type of model.
The reticence, perhaps, to the extent that there is such a reticence to articulate principles of Catholic social teaching in terms of natural law,
mm-hmm.
Is certainly something that one can notice, as you pointed out. But I'm wondering, is it a function of the, I won't say the complete disappearance, but certainly the weakening of a consensus, the significant weakening of consensus about the semantic of natural law in our public discourse? So I'm wondering, I guess, is it a symptom, or is it perhaps a motor of that as well, or something in between?
I think you've hit on something very important, because it's very true today that if you talk to, for example, most people in Western countries and you say the phrase natural law, they have no idea what you're talking about. Or they think you mean Charles Darwin and some sort of naturalistic explanation of reality. But because that mode of discourse has disappeared from a lot of secular thinking, and it's certainly not as present in, for example, Catholic intellectual life as it was, in which I happen to think it should be much more present. So I think there's a couple of things going on. One is that because understanding of these concepts is relatively weak in the world around the church, I think there are many Catholics who are reluctant to employ this type of language, which my view is, no, I think we actually should be employing this language much more rigorously, because the modern world is always talking about reason. It's always talking about how we need to be reasonable, how we have to take reason seriously. And like Leo XIII and plenty of other Catholics, I think that natural law is right reason, and that we need, precisely if you're going to engage people on the grounds of reason, which they claim to value themselves, then we shouldn't be afraid to invoke full-bodied conceptions of reason. Precisely because I think then you can say, well, we're meeting you on your own terms. You claim to be about reason. You claim to be reasonable people. Okay, let's talk about reason in a full-bodied conception of this idea. And I think that would be a very important contribution that the Church could be making to public discourse today, which to my mind is increasingly characterized by sentimentalism, emotivism, and sheer incoherence. And natural law forces you to get away from those ways of thinking about the world.
Which are characteristics of what's called in fashionable academic circles post-modernity.
Right. It's that.
So the rational engagement works for modernity.
Right.
Does it work now?
Well, I think it's what's interesting in that regard is that if the places where you would think that reason was taken most seriously or should be taken most seriously, i.e. the university, which we often like to think of as temples of reason, unfortunately in much of the West today, that's precisely where you find some of this type of anti-reason emotivist discourse dominating the type of discussions that we have. So much so that if one articulates a view and someone disagrees with it, the response of the person who disagrees now is not to say, well, I disagree with you and here's why. The response now is to say, well, that offends me. And so therefore we can't have a discussion about this anymore. And this is very, very widespread in many Western universities. And I think that that's something that if the Church was speaking much more explicitly about natural law and reason, whether it's in social questions, political questions, economic questions, or moral questions, that would help inject a certain degree of much-needed seriousness into public discourse, which even, I think, many non-believers would take seriously insofar as many, many people are tired of emotivist discourse. They're tired of this sort of sentimentalism and populism that dominates a lot of public discussion and are looking for an institution or a body of people that are committed to reason and are inviting people into what you might call what Paul did when he went into the temple in Greece, in Athens, and talked about how reason is very important and we can know God through reason.
When he went up to the Areopagus.
That's
there.
Right.
Now, of course, it bears mention that that didn't go as well for Paul as perhaps he
No,
had.
It's right. But some people said, well, that's very interesting. Others laughed at him. But it also says that some said, we want to know more about this, and they ended up converting.
The Holy Father has been praised in Catholic circles and in the secular media for what I think might be fairly described as his sensitivity to the feelings, the sentiments of those who don't share the Church's presuppositions about the nature of the human person and the way that states ought to relate to the citizenries whose lives they are to order. At the same time, he has warned of precisely this false sentimentality that ends up producing a false mercy, counterfeit money,
right.
As it were.
Cheap mercy.
Those warnings of his have been less widely reported.
Yes.
They're not insignificant, are they?
No, because it's very clear that the Holy Father wants to reach out to the peripheries. And by that, he doesn't just literally mean people living on the very margins of society. He wants to reach out to people who are distant from the Church. And that includes a lot of elite opinion within the world today. So he makes it very clear that he wants to engage in dialogue. He wants to meet people where they are. But he's also said on many occasions, and as you say, this has been less reported, and maybe it's also because people are less interested in hearing this side of the Holy Father's thought, that any such discussion has to be based upon commonly accepted principles, principles that people can know through reason, that principles that are universally accessible to people. Because it's one thing to use the language of mercy and outreach and dialogue and things like that, but if reason and truth are not part of that discussion, then all you end up having is an exchange of sentiment, an exchange of emotions, an exchange of feelings. And you can't base rational arguments upon feelings and sentiments. You need to base them on principles that are true, that are right, that withstand criticism if you're going to have a coherent argument. And that assumes, of course, that you're interested in having a coherent argument in the first place. And there are some people in, let's call it, the world who do want that. And there are others who don't, because I think many people, when they discover where right reason takes us in terms of thinking about moral questions, social questions, political questions, economic questions, they don't want to go down that path because in many cases it means change. Change for their lives, change for the way they think about themselves and other people, and even radical changes in the way politically that many societies are developing in the West today.
Some of my own students have been surprised with the degree to which it is possible to entertain, to take seriously, and to consider respectfully positions with which one is, to say the least, profoundly uneasy. The work of Acton engages people across a broad spectrum.
Yes, including many people who very much disagree with our take on economics, for example. In the broader public discussion, it's very clear, I think, that within the Church and outside the Church, there is massive disagreement right now about what is happening within economic life, particularly in the West, what are the most optimal ways forward, and also different questions like, well, what does inequality mean? What does that mean in the economy? Any number of these very touchy, hot subjects, which I think at the moment are not being particularly well discussed because there isn't a type of commonly agreed framework of the type that, for example, Leo XIII tried to set out in Rerum Novarum. So if this conference achieves anything, and I should mention we have, for example, the papal theologian, Father Gercik, is speaking. He's giving one of the keynote addresses at the conference, and he'll be talking very much about how Rerum Novarum sets us up for a very coherent discussion of contemporary economic problems, which I think is a very interesting approach. I think if the conference allows the development and furthering of a coherent framework for thinking through often very controversial, difficult questions like economic inequality, like globalization, like the nature of the market, like the ups and downs and the negative side of markets, but also a critique of the new emerging socialism and, frankly, populism that we see around much of the world. If we can help to contribute to a more stable, coherent framework in which things like reason but also empirical evidence are taken seriously, then that surely, I think, is a step forward in a world which many people don't like coherent frameworks, where they're not inclined to think about empirical evidence, where they're not interested in empirical evidence when it contradicts what they think is the right path forward. Or even something like inequality. We often talk about inequality as if it's always bad. Well, Leo XIII is very clear in Rerum Novarum that not all forms of inequality are unjust, that there are just forms of inequality, and that in many respects God has ordered the world in such a way that inequality is in many respects a natural feature of the social order. Are there forms of inequality that are unjust? Absolutely. But not all are. So just establishing that point, I think, would be an advance in a discussion in a world in which there's this assumption that inequality is per se always wrong.
Thank you very much and best of luck with the conference and heading into the future.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be with you again.
Dr. Samuel Gregg, the Director of Research at the Acton Institute for Religion and Liberty there. He was speaking with me, Chris Altieri.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.